From India's largest newsroom, I'm Arun George, and this is the Times of India podcast. Harinder Baweja has covered various conflicts across the country in over four decades of reporting. Having worked in multiple publications over the years, she has written about terrorism in Punjab and later in Kashmir, terror groups operating from Pakistan, internal security, illegal immigration, and many other subjects. Many of the stories are dealt with in her new book titled They Will Shoot You, Madam, which is part memoir and part analysis of various internal security issues and conflicts that she has reported on and have shaped the country over decades. In today's episode, we're in conversation with Harinder Baweja about the book and lessons she's taken away from her reportage. We talk about terrorism in Punjab and Kashmir, the games intelligence agencies play, making trips to Pakistan, and how she dealt with being told not to write things in national interest.
I know you pointed out the problems with this question, but do you feel like being a woman covering subjects like terrorism, security, conflict, you approach it from a different angle and you have a different viewpoint? And I ask this because there's often this allegation, at least among the male journalists, that it even gives you more concessions being of the opposite gender.
Thank you for calling out my gender in the very first question. I don't think men will ever get asked such a question, but I'm very happy to answer it. Women have broken various glass ceilings, but even though they've shown their worth, they keep getting asked this question. In fact, the men are the ones who call our gender out. We don't seek attention because we are women. I have never sought that concession, and I've spent 40 years in the profession. Actually, I have enjoyed covering conflict because I realized that conflict was not about counting the number of people dead or the, you know, number of terrorists arrested. What attracted me to the subject of terrorism, security, and conflict was always the sociology and psychology of violence. Why do people pick up the gun? What forces them to turn their bodies into missiles? What is it that indoctrinates them? So I have always seen myself as a journalist, never as a woman journalist, and may I add, never as a Sikh journalist. The reason I'm saying Sikh journalist is because when I started out taking baby steps in the field of conflict, my editor chose me because he thought a Sikh journalist would get better access in a place like Punjab, where the insurgency was flaming. Bhindranwale was out on a killing spree. The only access that I've got as a woman is to other fellow women. And most of them have been victims of violence. They felt comfortable talking to me because they probably felt that I would understand their pain and their grief. To answer the question again a little differently, being a woman, for me, I've had to navigate very difficult landmines. I've had to be very careful about not stepping on landmines because of my gender. Because when I was posted in Punjab, and I described that in my book, it's a bit personal, but I was singled out for an attack that was very vicious, and I don't think I deserve that.
You know, the point that you ended the last answer with, that's also one of the things you list in your chapter on Yasin Malik, which is really a chapter that makes one's skin crawl while you're reading it. In the same chapter, you talk of the sort of casual harassment you faced again by this time by a political leader as who you've not named. But could you talk about that sort of casual sexual harassment that comes with being a woman in a beat that is perhaps dominated by men?
Well, men think it's a field that they should dominate. You know, men think they'll do better in zones full of guns and bullets and bombs. I'm very happy to navigate that zone. And I've been doing it for 40 years. I have always approached various subjects, and I'm talking about male subjects, in a very professional manner. Now, you use the word casual harassment. I would not even call it casual, Arun. It was serious. Now, imagine you're referring to the Yasin Malik chapter. Now, here's this guy who has been accused not just of killing four Indian Air Force officers. He was also accused of kidnapping Rubaiya Saeed, who was then the daughter of the serving Home Minister of India, Mufti Mohammad Saeed, right? Now, covering conflict also brings you face to face with another very interesting aspect, and I've always watched that with a lot of awe and wonderment. It has given me an insight into how intelligence agencies work. I'm bringing this up because it's in relation to Yasin Malik. And my first encounter with him was when he was actually helped out of Tihar jail, where he was lodged for the very crimes that I've listed out. And then I got to know that the Intelligence Bureau had co-opted him and were planning to use him to travel from Delhi, where he was imprisoned, to Srinagar. And their hope was that he would help restart a political process in Kashmir. Now, I'm going on the same flight as Yasin Malik. I called him. He gave me his flight details. I made sure I booked myself on the same flight. And he said he would give me an interview. Basically, he had a long journey from the airport to the colony Mysuma where he lived, and that took 6-7 hours. Yasin Malik had a medical problem. He had a heart problem, okay? And before he could speak, he just swooned and he fell, and he had to be hospitalized. Now, I went through anxious, tense moments because all I wanted was an interview with this guy, you know, the so-called new Mahatma Gandhi of Jammu and Kashmir. I'm sorry to say, I saw a very different side to the guy who the people thought was the hero of their liberation. He sort of put himself into the Mahatma Gandhi frame, and his aides called me a couple of days later. He was still in the hospital, and I was told, please come late in the night because there are too many visitors during the day. I did not suspect anything when I was told that, although I knew that traveling after the sun sets in Srinagar is fraught with risk. Not only for me, for all journalists, and especially for the Kashmiri taxi driver. Because once he drops me back to the hotel, I know how difficult it was for them to drive back to their own homes, right? So here I am taking the risk of driving after sunset, going past security bunkers, entering the hospital, and he was there laid out on a bed with curtains drawn all around him. You know, he was not in a private room. He was in a ward. I sat on the stool. There were a couple of visitors. And then I said, can we please start the interview? And to my utter disbelief and shock, he extended his hand and said, Mujhse dosti karogi. I just froze on that stool. And you might ask me why I chose to write about this. Actually, I also asked myself that question. But I finally wrote about it because I realized that it takes years to process behavior like this. And maybe I had the cathartic comfort of words to finally talk about this in the book. Because a book is also a place in which, you know, you can narrate your personal journey. When you're writing for a publication, it's a story that you focus on. Your own personal experience doesn't get space.
You started at the sort of peak of terrorism in Punjab. And, you know, at that time, the movement for Khalistan had picked up a lot of steam. And yet, almost 4 decades later, we talk of this movement as being a very real and active threat to the country, despite multiple, years of stamping it out. How do you view this sort of resurgence of Khalistan in our sort of collective conscience?
I think collective conscience is probably the right phrase, because it's not that Punjab has gun-wielding terrorists anymore. But what I've understood after covering conflict for 4 decades is that the embers are always easy to stoke. The embers never die. So the slogan for Khalistan, which had thousands of followers in Bhindranwale's time, and then many thousands of followers after Operation Blue Star, when Mrs. Gandhi paid for her life. And then we saw the horrific anti-Sikh carnage that took place under the government's nose in the capital of the country. These are all part of the collective conscience of communities. This is what conflict does to communities. You learn to live your life, you learn to move on in many ways, but in your mind, there is always an ember, and there are always people willing to stoke that ember, willing to, make use of it when it suits them. Like a few years ago, you saw Amritpal Singh fly in from Dubai and model himself after Bhindranwale. He was somebody who had not even kept his hair, as Sikhs are supposed to, for all the while that he was living in Dubai. But he landed in Punjab, and this turban tying ceremony was held with grand fanfare, and he chose the location well. It was done in Bhindranwale's village in Rode in Punjab. So to answer your question, you do see the sentiment for Khalistan still occupies mind space in India, but in the diaspora abroad, especially in the US and Canada, it is much more visible on the streets. So it's very interesting that when it starts, conflict is murky, and that murkiness, it just spans decades. I mean, I've seen decades melt in the process of covering conflict.
Do you think that it's also about how we deal with these conflicts? Because, you write about KPS Gill and his sort of ending of terrorism in Punjab through means that are, don't fit within the ambit of the criminal justice system necessarily. You have that same model being replicated across states. Do you feel like the way you end a conflict also results in those creation of embers that can just never be put out?
So KPS Gill is often credited for having ended the violence in Punjab, but I can tell you, and I was posted in Punjab, that his means were extremely uncomfortable because they were extremely unlawful. He promoted people who were willing to blindfold themselves to the law, to what their police uniform demanded of them. They were umpteen instances of fake encounters, of innocents being killed. And I think the killing of innocents is perhaps a part of the collective conscience that we just spoke about. As I mentioned in the book, five officers who KPS Gill had promoted out of rank, and sort of he had given them full liberty to break the law, they actually ended up taking their own lives. So conflict comes as a heavy price. Now, imagine a policeman who was given the freedom to tackle the terrorists in Punjab, ending up on a railway line, dead, because the weight of the law is also a burden. And in many senses, and in many instances, I've seen it has caught up with the people who have tried to break it.
You spoke of this sort of use of unlawful force to end conflicts or even bring in law and order. We're at a time where, again, we are at a stage where encounter killings and even shooting of suspects in the foot have become a sort of regular practice, and I even doubt it. How do you view that, given the sort of long view of history, in the sense of this isn't something that hasn't been done in the past? How effective is it really over time?
I think encounter killings only add to conflict, and they make them even murkier.
Mm-hmm.
In my experience, I have begun to understand that people agitate and take to the streets when they know that an encounter is false, that it is fake, that it is blatantly unlawful. And then that, adds fresh fuel to the already prevalent violence. I have not seen justice ever being delivered after a fake encounter killing. And that adds to emotional debris amongst communities who are at the receiving end of conflict. And instead of giving them dignity and justice, instead of applying the balm, we only end up scratching wounds, and scratching wounds in conflict zones is extremely dangerous.
And in terms of just law and order restoration, that sort of where there is no actual conflict, but it serves that quick need for implementation of justice, do you see that as being at least a short-term benefit, that you have a sort of better image to tout, if nothing else?
I would never endorse an image that flows from, a fake killing. We've seen underworld dons being taken to court in Uttar Pradesh and being shot dead while they are in handcuffs and while they have the police around them. I mean, how can you endorse such a killing? You must let the law take its course. Now, the argument given by the keepers of the law is that the justice system, takes very long. I'm sorry, that doesn't apply. If overhaul the systems, appoint more judges, do whatever you want, but encounter killings have to be denounced.
In your book, you also write about your meeting with the gangster Chota Rajan and the sort of Indian government's plan to use him to eliminate Dawood Ibrahim. And that's an operation that was either intentionally or unintentionally thwarted by the Mumbai police. At the same time, in the book, you're critical of the Modi government's decision to use contract killers in the Panun case, which has been a source of friction between India and US. What for you are the differences between the two cases?
I mean, I have not said one is good and the other is not. That is not the point I've made in any portion of the book. In the Chota Rajan chapter, I have spoken about my own meeting with him, how I was able to access him, how he was outed. And there is no doubt that he was outed because his sharpshooters were caught on a busy street of the national capital, in the company of a former director of the Intelligence Bureau. Now, there are games that, agencies play. I've seen that. I've seen all agencies. And when I say agencies, I don't mean only intelligence agencies. I also mean the local police, the paramilitary forces, the army. So when I say agencies, I include all the ones that I've mentioned. Chota Rajan never succeeded in his mission to get Dawood. There was a plan to try and get him, because his daughter was getting married. And as we know, she married the son of a famous cricketer in Pakistan, Javed Miadad. And I think the strategy was that there is no way that a father would stay away from his own daughter's wedding. So there was a plan that was being put into place. Now, that is the work of intelligence agencies. Right? So it's not always that intelligence agencies get their plots right. I mean, what happened in the case of Panun? We walked into a trap. When I say we, I mean the agencies. I mean, the person who was plotting Panun's killing, and that is public knowledge. It is in black and white in affidavits submitted, by the US administration to its courts on how the agent, an intelligence agent from India, was plotting and planning Panun's killing and ended up walking into a trap laid at their end. So one has to be extremely careful about such operations. I'm not saying they'll always go according to plan, but interestingly, I also feel that if Chota Rajan is in jail today, it is because that is the safest place for him. Otherwise, Dawood and his gang would still be madly hunting for him. They would be out to get any possible details of where he's hiding, what he's doing. And Chota Rajan knew that. He said that to me in an interview as well, that my closest associates can be bought, because in this profession, money plays a very important role. So the only point I tried to make was to talk about how intelligence agencies operate, how they plan operations. And I think the main point is that it's foolish to be caught for something like this.
Describing the events that led to Operation Blue Star, you write that political misadventures crafted with electoral strategies as their core don't always produce intended results. What for you were the lessons from events like Blue Star and Black Thunder that remain relevant today and yet seem ignored?
Operation Blue Star was, in fact, the culmination of a political misadventure, which had been crafted with electoral strategies, at its core. All contemporary students of history would know that Bhindranwale was allowed certain freedoms in the hope that he would be able to curb the influence of the Akalis, which was the most, powerful political force in Punjab at the time. But look at what it's resulted into. You had an attack on the Golden Temple, which for the Sikhs is the most sacred place of worship. You saw a serving prime minister being assassinated. Till today, 41 years later, Lieutenant General Barar now, he was a major general when he led the troops into the Golden Temple and, had to finally use tanks to pulverize the Akal Takht to get to Bhindranwale and his military advisor, Shah Beg Singh. People have not forgotten that. And why do I say that? One of the assassins who pumped bullets into Mrs. Gandhi in 1984, his son today is a member of parliament, Arun. That's what we're talking about. That's what political misadventurism can result in.
So you've gone to Pakistan twice, or is it thrice?
Twice. I mean,
Twice.
to POK twice.
POK twice and Pakistan
Multiple
multiple
2020.
times.
Yeah.
So could you talk about what it's like to for one visit there? Could you talk about your impressions, one of Pakistan-occupied Kashmir during your visits there, and also of the Lashkar headquarters when you were there?
Let me answer your question on Pakistan-occupied Kashmir first, because it's not like you can walk into POK or its capital of Muzaffarabad. No Indian can walk into Muzaffarabad. Muzaffarabad is not even listed as an option on the visa form that you fill in at the Pakistan High Commission's office in Delhi. It is only through contacts and sources, and I'm lucky and fortunate to have made many on my various trips to Pakistan, that I was allowed to go to POK. And their hope was that I would come back thinking that, this POK is full of Kashmiris who have run away from the Indian side of Kashmir because they have been, you know, hounded by the Indian security forces. When I went there, I actually managed, with some help from the tenacity that I've learned to develop over the years, I was able to puncture a hole into their narrative that their Kashmir is really the Azad Kashmir. You know, they take great pride in saying that their Kashmir is Azad, whereas our Kashmir, that is the Indian side of Kashmir, is occupied. Right? So I managed, and I did it with difficulty. In fact, at one point, I had a crowd of people surround me, and all I could hear was the chants of Indian dog, go back, Indian dog, go back. I've learned to fold my sleeves and dig my heels in. I was able to go to another so-called refugee camp where, again, I was told that, you know, it's full of people who've had to flee parts of Srinagar and the border districts along the line of control because of being maltreated by the Indian security forces. I actually managed to speak to women. And because I'd been a regular visitor to Kashmir, fortunately for me, I've learned to speak 5 sentences of Kashmiri. And just to make the person comfortable, the women comfortable, when I was talking to them, I asked in Kashmiri what their name was. And I was shocked beyond belief to see blank faces. And then when I repeated the same question in Urdu, Hindi, I was told, oh, itna zulm hua hai, I've been through so much, I have faced so many atrocities, I've forgotten my mother tongue. Now, I'm sorry, show me a person who forgets their mother tongue. So actually, POK was an eye-opener for me. I mean, going to Muzaffarabad not once but twice was quite an eye-opener for me because I got access to an area that was out of bounds for Indian journalists. And I was able to puncture a hole into their narrative that we have nothing to hide. I found out that they actually have a lot to hide. And I wrote about it. And what happened after that? I was blacklisted. And I don't know whether I should say also happily deported at one point, but certainly joined a list of very few who've been deported from Pakistan for what they've, you know, ended up writing as journalists. Maybe it's an honor. Soon after the very audacious 26/11 attacks in Mumbai, you know, which, and let's not forget, it was one of the worst attacks India had faced. I remember waking up to a message from my editor. I was with Tehelka then. Waking up to a message from Tarun Tejpal saying, apply for a visa to Pakistan. And honestly, I said, really? He thinks I'm going to get a visa? 10 days after Mumbai has been attacked, why will Pakistan want an Indian journalist sniffing around on their soil so soon? Because Ajmal Kasab, one terrorist, was captured alive, as we know. I was actually quite surprised because I did get a visa. And I was very clear in my head. There was only one story that made sense to me, and that was to visit the headquarters of the Lashkar-e-Taiba. It's known worldwide as the headquarters of the Lashkar-e-Taiba. I did not go there expecting to see guns or expecting to see, you know, militants being trained. Arun, let's be clear. All organizations, all outfits, whether it's the police, the political, or the terrorist, propaganda is oxygen for them, right? Even before I boarded my flight to Lahore, I read about the Lashkar-e-Taiba's communication chief escorting a group of international journalists into what by then had been renamed from Lashkar-e-Taiba to Jamaat-ud-Dawa. terrorist organizations are very adept at quickly changing their identity. The same Lashkar-e-Taiba is now the resistance front, which issued a press release soon after the Pehlgam attack and then withdrew it. So when you cover conflict, as I've done year after year, decade after decade, you know how they operate. You know how swiftly they are able to change their identities, their bank accounts also, because they get frozen. So I did not expect to sort of see terrorists being trained. But Ajmal Kasab had talked about Muridke and the Lashkar-e-Taiba headquarters over there. He had been trained over there. I was lucky and fortunate, I feel, to be able to go in there, even though they called it a charitable organization. If you read the book, and I've produced portions of the conversation that I had inside the headquarters, which, by the way, was targeted and destroyed on May 7th, to be precise, in the course of Operation Sindoor. Pakistan itself is not denying the fact that it is their headquarters. There are videos now of them rebuilding it. We have seen photographs of another headquarters, the Jaish-e-Mohammed in Bawalpur, where the Pakistani army is present in uniform at the last rites of the terrorists. So they can pretend to be a charity, but we must do our job, and that's what we do as journalists.
In multiple instances in your book, at least, you talk of a time where you encountered the phrase to report on something would be anti-national. It's become more of a catchphrase since perhaps you first started hearing it. How often have you had that thrown at you to prevent you from writing something? And what are the perils of buying into that sort of you're going to hurt nationalism?
So the first time I heard the word anti-national, and it was not a label that was being thrown at me. I just come back from a trip to Jammu and Kashmir, where I had been given access to militants who had surrendered, you know, and they had surrendered either to the Border Security Force, the BSF, or to the Indian Army. At that time, these were the two main agencies which were operating on the ground. So after being given access to, there were about 40, 50 of them in one room, and I managed to talk to them. There was a minder there, an officer from the Indian Army, who I requested that if he could please, you know, just let me talk to these people in private. I mean, the stories I heard were shocking. And I was talking about conflict being murky. I realized how murky it can be that day, when the surrendered militants opened up finally and they spoke to me in hushed whispers because they knew there was a minder outside. But they actually told me that, you know, even when they go to like the neighborhood shop to buy doodh and patti, either the BSF jawan or somebody from the Indian Army will come to them and say, oh, why did you surrender to one agency? Why didn't you surrender to us? You see, at that time, there was a lot of pressure on the units that were operating there. Their progress was being measured on a scale. I was talking about not getting caught in the numerical aspect of terrorism. But that is how the security forces were operating. Like, we've arrested so many. So many have surrendered to us. We've killed so many. We've captured so many. We've got so many guns that we have, you know, etc., etc. So when I came back to Delhi, and I remember going to meet a senior officer in the Home Ministry, and I was very disturbed with what I had heard, because I realized that this was only going to make the conflict zone worse. You know, instead of trying to find peace, they were actually adding to a conflict. So I narrated my experience to this high-ranking official in the Home Ministry, and he said, oh, please don't write about this because this is anti-national. So I'm like, excuse me, I'm not being anti-national. You need to address your officers within the security matrix. You need to talk to the paramilitary. You need to speak to your counterparts in the Ministry of Defense to say that these things should not be happening on the ground. But now again, as you say, that was a few decades ago. Today, what we are called prostitutes, we are told go to Pakistan. You know, at the drop of a pin, we are called anti-national. Frankly, I have a very thick skin. It doesn't bother me. You can call me what you want. I know my remit. My remit is to hold a mirror to what is happening on the ground. And my remit is to point out the mistakes made by governments, because they are the ones answerable to the people and to the media. And I'll continue doing my job.
You know, you've been taken out of a car at gunpoint in multiple cases. And yet in each case, you're being able to say you were a journalist, helped. It wasn't a problem for you. We're in a time where in a place like Gaza, you have journalists being targeted and even being accused of being terrorists. But what are the big changes you see in how journalists and their work is viewed?
It is a matter of shame for me that, you know, that we mention journalists in Gaza and journalists in India in the same breath. Let me be very honest with you. Often, you know, now by my publisher, earlier by my editors, I've often heard them say, oh, you're very courageous, you're fearless. I would like to point to the fact that it's not me who was fearless. It was journalism that was fearless at the time that I practiced it. I still do, but obviously, large parts of the media are what are now described as Godi media. We're more interested in milestone birthdays and anniversaries, you know, than we are about our basic work, which is to report the truth. So the less said about Indian journalism, the better. What we're doing now, what are we doing? One day we're taking Karachi, the next day we're taking Lahore. But I'm sorry, that's not the kind of journalism I was taught, and that's not the kind of journalism I practice.
Today's episode was produced by Jairaj Singh and Sahil Gupta. For a daily spotlight on people, ideas, and stories that matter, subscribe to us. We're available on the Times of India website, Spotify, Apple, Amazon, or wherever else you get your podcasts. For any news, tips, or feedback, mail me at arun.george@timesgroup.com.